Thursday afternoon, October 5th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up about pretty much an even 100 points so far on the day. We'll check in later in the program with Mark Hamrick, a senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com. We often talk to him on the day the jobless numbers come out. Today, we're going to get a little preview. The figure comes out for September tomorrow morning, so we'll talk to Mark about that. I think he's expecting a bit of a drop. If we have time, I want to ask him about the VIX as well. The VIX is down again today. Looks like it will close at a record low there. That's the fear index. And I worry about a little irrational exuberance. I don't know. We'll talk to Mark about that coming up. Ian Scher from CNET is in our second half hour. Bill Geiger on just around the corner as well. We'll talk to Bill about some retirement ideas. But we're going to start the day with a little castor oil. How's that sound? We're talking to on the phone, Joe Caldwell, who is the Director of Long-Term Services and Support at the National Council on Aging. A couple numbers for you. A third of Americans 40 and older have done no planning for their long-term health care needs. A private room in a nursing home goes for about $8,000 a month now, nearly $100,000 a year. That is according to a new survey from Genworth Financial. So on the phone line, Joe Caldwell to talk about all of that. Joe, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So I know you wear a few hats. One of them is, do you still teach at UIC?
I do. I'm an adjunct professor there. And I work in D.C. for the National Council on Aging, which is a nonprofit organization that does advocacy and service work around older adults.
All right, so this Genworth study now, and Genworth, they sell long-term health insurance, so let's just say that it's in their interest to scare us into buying it. But their numbers are pretty staggering, I think. $97,000 a year for a private room at a nursing home, 85 if you're getting a semi-private room. But even adult daycare, 5 days a week, $18,000 a year, $45,000 a year for assisted living. The costs are huge. And, you know, I was just talking to some people off the air. I think a lot of people think that this is the sort of thing that Medicare will cover for them. And, Joe, it just won't, will it?
No, it won't. You're absolutely right. You know, a lot of surveys have been done, and most people assume that Medicare will pay for long-term care, but it doesn't. It may cover for a little bit of nursing home care after you've been in a hospital, but we're talking about long-term care, so people that are going to need care for, you know, perhaps years, people that need assistance with, you know, showering, bathing, taking medications, shopping. You think about people with Alzheimer's or dementia. So that's kind of the population we're talking about. And yeah, Medicare does not cover any of these costs.
And Medicaid will, but you have to be almost, well, nearly penniless, right? I think it's down to $2,000 before Medicaid kicks in, which means if your parents are nursing home age and they don't have insurance, all of the wealth they've accumulated during their lifetime may well go toward that nursing home.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's kind of morally, you know, outrageous that, you know, we tell people to save money throughout their lifetime to, you know, put away some money, and then you know, these costs come in and there's really no insurance coverage. So, yeah, it exhausts people's money. Like $100,000 for a nursing home, you know, that exhausts what people really have, you know, saved away in savings pretty quickly.
And it's spent during a time that they're not able to truly enjoy it. I mean, it may sustain them, but it's not certainly bringing them, it's not spent in a pleasurable way by any means. But you said something in an interview, I think. I'm not quite sure these are your words. I might be making a leap, but tell me if I'm wrong. You know, it's interesting. In my place of work, I, you know, have pressure, or I'm encouraged to contribute to my 401k or to buy my pet insurance and all of that stuff. But there's not much of incentive for long-term health care insurance. If there was a real revolution for that when people were younger, that could really change the equation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's something people do need to think about and think about early on. And it's hard because people don't want to think about, you know, that they might become disabled someday. But the fact is, we pretty much all are. The facts are, you know, about 70% of people, if we reach old age, are going to need some sort of long-term care. And it's something you do have to think about. And you know, plan and look into different options.
Well, you're not with a company that sells insurance, so are you in a position to assess them? I mean, I'm assuming it's money well spent, but it's money that's hard to spend.
It is, and we do encourage people to plan and to look into long-term care insurance. You do have to be very careful what you're purchasing, and you know, look very, very closely at that. And the prices of long-term care insurance itself has continued to go up. So a lot of middle-class families can't even afford long-term care insurance anymore.
I mean, as the baby boomers start to move into these, although I suppose many of them already are there, but is this a ballooning crisis ahead of us?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it is. And, you know, the burden really falls a lot on family caregivers. You know, there's 40 million family caregivers right now that provide uncompensated care.
Mm-hmm.
AARP did a study that, you know, if you put a monetary value on that, it's something like $470 billion in, you know, unpaid care. So, you know, the burden really falls a lot on families. And, you know, it's something we need to address at the national level. Organization has been trying to do that. But, you know, there's just not a lot of political will yet to really grapple with this aging baby boom generation, yeah, and how we're going to pay for long-term care.
We're going to have to do it ourselves. Joe Caldwell, exactly. Director, National Council on Aging. Thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good. Hope we can talk again. You bet. Bill Geiger is in the studio as well. Our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back, friend.
Nice to be here, sir.
All right. So, you know, we were talking just not too long ago about retirement and retirement homes and nursing homes and things like that, and about the cost of it. You know, and you've talked about the fact that preparing for retirement is sort of like being 20 to 30 years without a paycheck unless you do it right.
That's right. And one of the really, really big deals about retiring comfortable, and this dovetails exactly with the story you were telling, is the way you go through retirement really comfortably is having a very high level of dependable, sustainable income. Have you ever known anybody that had a big pension?
No.
No?
No.
Well, let me tell you, they're the happiest people.
There are a few government workers out there with them, I'll tell you.
They're the happiest people around because they know exactly how they're going to pay their bills for the rest of their lives. Well, if you're in your late 50s to early 60s, you can actually create your own effective retirement plan, your own pension plan, if you will. Basically, your late 50s, early 60s, you reallocate a portion of your portfolio toward income. And if you do it soon enough, it can be really powerful. We had a couple come in a couple weeks ago, 60-year-old. They put $1.5 million. It's a little bit large,
mm-hmm,
from our normal conversation, but they put $1.5 million into an income strategy like this. In 7 years, they're going to have $120,000 a year guaranteed for the rest of their life. That's 10 grand a month. You were just talking about what's the cost of a nursing home,
right,
about being $100,000 a year. Well, there's $120,000 a year, whether they need it or not.
Right.
They've got an income coming in.
And so that's just the strategy, is to put your resources in a position to create income for you in retirement.
A part of your portfolio.
Okay.
You know, almost everybody comes in, everything is in growth. And they've got so much more risk than what they thought they did, and no real plan for how you're going to pay your bills. Well, the smart move is earlier on, reallocate a portion of your portfolio to create income. And that just, you just sleep better at night.
How do you figure out what proportion, or what's the math there?
It goes according to your age. It also goes according to how much you need. And it depends upon your lifestyle and what other monies you have coming in, like Social Security.
Right. I would imagine, I mean, part of what you do, or part of it is, I'm going to say hand-holding, but that's not quite the right word. But, you know, I mean, here we are in this market. It keeps going up and up and up. It's kind of, you know, tempting to stay in it or to not prepare for what's after this.
You know, it's so strange right now.
I mean, the VIX is at record lows. Everything's good. Nothing bad's going to happen, Bill Geiger.
People want to dance in the street, but at the same time, they're looking over their shoulder. because they know this can't go on forever. And the question is, when does it turn around? We don't know that. So your best option is, while it's still at the top of the market, to make some changes, to create some income, and to make your portfolio as bulletproof as humanly possible. Nothing's perfect, but it's better to have this conversation now at the top of the market than it is at the bottom of the market.
How do you know when it's time, when you've gotten there?
Late 50s, early 60s.
Right. And then that's when it's time to start moving that.
That's when it's time to really start getting serious about doing what I'm talking about.
And how do you know then when, I mean, is there a magic number or when you know you can retire? Like this can be my last paycheck?
Well, yeah, you can back into that. The couple we were talking about, we figured out between the $120,000 and their Social Securities, they were going to have about $180,000 a year. And for them, that was more than they needed, which is exactly where you want to be. You want to have more income coming in than what you need.
That's my life goal, my friend.
Exactly. I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, but the next five callers who call in today who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, we'll help them put together a full-blown retirement plan, and we're going to do it on a complimentary basis, Steve.
Bill Geiger, thanks very much. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
My pleasure, sir.
Pretty nice Thursday afternoon here in the beautiful month of October in the city of Chicago. Ian Schur is on a phone line. He's an executive editor at CNET. We talk to Ian from time to time about what's going on in the world of tech. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. You know, I kind of sometimes get talked out about things, you know, and I'm a little talked out about the whole Equifax story. It was bad. It was really bad. And the former CEO was on Capitol Hill yesterday, and I get all that. But the one angle that I think is interesting, and I do still want to talk about, is earlier this week, Rob Joyce, who is the cybersecurity coordinator at the White House, sort of floated, I think he was at a cybersecurity conference, floated this idea that we may one day get rid of or not depend on our Social Security numbers anymore, but find some sort of alternate form of identification. As I know, I mean, Social Security numbers were never really created to be our be-all and end-all forms of ID anyway.
Well, that's actually absolutely true. And what's funny, of course, is that over the years, they became that. I mean, if you went through this, I'm sure a lot of people have. You know, they used to post my grades in school with my Social Security number. They wouldn't put my name up there because they wanted to keep it private. And they would post these on like printed out papers on the door of the classroom.
With your whole number.
Easy to take. With the whole number. Like crazy, right? And my student ID was my Social Security number. I spoke with some people who told me that their driver's license numbers in some states were Social Security numbers at one point. And so it's like part of the interesting thing here is that, you know, before the internet came along, this whole system was pretty okay because to impersonate someone was really hard, right? You had to get the credit card application, you need to know where they were. I mean, all these things that once the internet popped up and all these public databases were easily accessible, and all I had to do to impersonate someone was to literally go to a website and fill out an application, suddenly this thing went bananas. And so it's good to see the government starting to respond. I don't know how we replace the Social Security number.
Well, that was why I have you on. Ian, that's the whole point. I want you here to tell me how.
Look, if I had the answer, I would be making a lot more money and doing a different job than this. But I think that the bottom line is that the problem we have today is that with a Social Security number, if I get my identity stolen, I am screwed. There is no way, because the government won't change my number. It is always going to be that one number. And so coming up with a system that allows it to change or figuring out a way to solve these issues is going to be incredibly important going forward.
Well, Joyce talked about something that they use, and I don't understand this, but similar to how you would log on at your bank account where they create these long chains of different digits. I mean, I'm not hip to all that. Do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff out there, right? So one of the things that he's ultimately talking about is that, you know, when you're logging into different systems, they have these processes now where they try to identify you with one way, right? Let's say you have a basic password, and then it can send you a text message or it can check with your phone and say, hey, is that really you? And stuff like that.
I see.
And what ultimately could happen right, and this is all just theoretical at this point, is trying to find those types of solutions. You know, another thing that a lot of companies are starting to look at is using biometrics, right? Literally your thumbprint or your face. And so your phone becomes the key, but what's really important is actually your body. And so whatever it takes to get there, like, I don't care if there's a number I no longer have to memorize, right? What I care about is whether or not my information is safe and secure, and when it's stolen, that there's a way to solve it.
Yeah, I have a
all I care about.
I have a relative who's like, he doesn't, and the story was, his health club was going to start using a thumbprint, I think it was, for entry rather than an ID card. And he was just loath to give away that personal, you know, very particular form of ID. He didn't want to share that. I mean, but I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems like that would be safer from hack than just a social security number.
Well, I mean, look, the problem is that any ID that can be taken and then, you know, used and then, you know, once it's stolen, it can't be changed, is a problem, right?
Yeah.
The thing that makes credit cards work so well is that those numbers can be changed on a dime, right? If I get my credit card stolen right now, I call my bank and they'll change my card number, they'll deactivate the old one and send me a new one. And same thing with our phones. When you activate at, you know, Apple Pay or Samsung Pay or whatever pay, it actually creates a new number every time it's checking to allow you to buy something. And so these systems work well because they've been able to identify you in a different way than a number that is static. And that's ultimately, I think, what we're going to end up doing.
All right, I want to move on to Twitter. You wrote a sort of a 7-question essay toward Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter. He was on Capitol Hill. Was that last week or the week before? Talking about
It was last week.
Yeah, talking about
it was last Thursday.
The Russian influence and stuff, and didn't really impress very many people. It sounds like he didn't impress you very much.
No, not at all. And in fact, I mean, this has been simmering for a while. You know, the reality is that we are getting to a point now where this nonstop, endless harassment that some people are experiencing on Twitter needs to be answered. And it's not that I expect a fix tomorrow, but I do expect Twitter to actually acknowledge that this is a problem they need to solve. And the problem is that, for the most part, Twitter has been completely opaque, and you can't tell what they're doing. They give these kind of ham-fisted statements that really don't always make sense compared to what they're actually doing. And you end up with these people who report criminal, sometimes, levels of harassment, and nothing happens. And it's just not okay.
Don't they have terms of service and rules, and if you violate the rules, you get knocked off?
That is the worst part about this, is that, you know, when last week...
I'm baiting you a little bit, but...
Of course, right? Last week, you could get me going for a while. Last week on Monday, you know, Twitter said that it was not going to take down a tweet from Donald Trump that pretty much clearly violated Twitter's terms of service. And look, I'm not criticizing the president, but I'm pointing out that they have rules. He broke them, essentially, when he was threatening the lives of the North Koreans. Twitter acknowledged that, but said that because he's a newsworthy person, he gets to basically go free.
Okay, so and you're so Dorsey. You're the CEO. What do you do? You've got the right. President of the United States who's breaking your rules. You can't delete a tweet from the President of the United States, right? What would you have him do?
No, this is really hard. These are very hard issues, which is why Dorsey has paid billions of dollars, okay? But no, this is definitely not an easy answer. But the thing is that I am actually dancing around part of the argument that Twitter functionally, as the way that Twitter works, is part of the problem. And I don't know if that's about anonymity, right? The fact that you can be anonymous and so you can create trolls and all that type of stuff. I don't know if it's because of the way that it's so easy to harass people and they can't get rid of you easily, or they can't remove you easily. But I'm actually convinced that the way Twitter is designed is the problem. The way people use it is also a problem, no question. There is a cultural problem with the internet, but that's a larger problem than Twitter. But Twitter needs to solve this specific problem, which is that it's so easy for people to go on mass harassment campaigns against people and ruin their lives.
All right,
and that's just not okay.
You've got 30 seconds. How do they fix it?
You know, I think that ultimately one of the great answers is going to be that they need to actually get rid of the anonymity. I know it's a terrible thing. A lot of people love that it's anonymous, and there's a lot of discussion about how it helps political dissidents in countries that are repressive. But this is becoming a huge problem. And, you know, you look at, I have the story on CNET. It's worth reading some of the data in there. It's just incredible how large these harassment campaigns have been. And it's not the one answer, but it's one of the answers.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. If you've got something to say, put your name behind it. Ian Schur, executive editor at CNET. Check out his 7 questions for Jack Dorsey and a lot of other great stories there. Ian, nice to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Tomorrow is the first Friday of the month, October 6th, and that means that the September jobless numbers will be coming out. I think we've been averaging about 175,000 jobs created a month during the year so far. Mark Hamrick is a senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com, and he joins us from time to time to explain the numbers. Today he's going to predict them. Mark, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
All right. So do you have are you pulling out a magic prediction? Are you going to give us your trends, or what do you think?
Well, this is one where it's a little like spinning somebody around with a blindfold and asking them to hit the dartboard maybe after a few cocktails, because this is going to be very difficult. The hurricanes, the flooding, the storms, the disruptions that occurred will have really blown this number off track. And so I think instead of trying to pinpoint the number, which is very difficult for this month alone, what I would tell people is, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the numbers behind the curtain this time, because it's going to be very noisy. And what we're really thinking is that the underlying strength of the U.S. economy remains intact. And that's leaving aside, or not to be forgetful of, the fact that many people had their lives, their businesses, indeed some lost their lives, were turned upside down. But in terms of what's going on with the economy, don't be shocked if you get a very low number with payrolls. The unemployment rate's probably about the same at 4.4%. But we'll expect that as the year proceeds, the economy actually gets a benefit from the rebuilding and the recovery, as we saw with auto sales really perked up as people got their cash from insurance companies.
And it's unfortunate that we're learning more about Puerto Rico only because they've been hit with a terrible disaster. But, I mean, it's perfectly logical. I knew the Puerto Ricans were U.S. citizens and all of that. I didn't figure that they counted. I mean, I guess it just didn't think about the fact that they count in the unemployment figures as well. Now, we won't see their numbers this month, right? That will likely be next month.
Correct. You know, this will largely be a Texas, Louisiana, Florida story in terms of the most significant disruption in employment. And people sometimes say, well, what about Florida? What about Texas? And the fact is, as we get both the state and the metropolitan numbers after this federal government report in the morning, so we'll get a better idea of, let's say, how Miami fared, how Beaumont, Texas fared, how Houston fared, Jacksonville, et cetera. And then, as you say, the impacts will be continue to be felt in the months ahead, first from Puerto Rico in the following month, and then, as I say, you know, as money flows in to rebuild, insurance companies, you know, deliver their payments.
Right.
And people start to rebuild their homes, get their businesses going, that'll be a positive.
All right, this might be a naive question, but is there a scenario where these storms could be job creators? I mean, net creators?
Oh, no, I think it's a good question, and I think it's true. You know, think of all the construction workers who are heading to these regions in the United States to, you know, do the essentially the teardowns on the homes that were flooded, and then to build them back up, and then you know, there's going to be infrastructure repair where electric lines were blown down. That's already obviously begun to occur, particularly in the Keys and so forth. So that's the most important point, I think, that as we look at the national economy, is it's a negative at first, it's a positive later.
3.1% growth in the second quarter. Is that sustainable through the end of the year?
We might take a little bit of a hit in the third quarter, but that auto sales number was a real pleasant surprise that we had for September, the ninth month, obviously. And so, you know, numbers are tracking all over the place, you know, sort of 1 to 2% plus on the third quarter. And you probably do get a rebound in the fourth quarter. So, you know, for the course of the year, you know, the longer term trend has basically been annual growth of 2.2%. We'll be pretty close to that this year, I
think. Okay, we're at the cocktail party. We've had 2 or 3 drinks. Your blindfold is on. Dart in your hand. I'm going to spin you around. What do you make of the VIX? Because the VIX looks like it might set another record low close today.
Yeah.
It's the fear index, it's called. I sometimes worried that we don't have enough fear.
I think you're probably right. A lot of this is driven by algorithms. So the computers are doing more of the investing behavior. We don't know what happens when fear actually spikes and then the computers have to react. Depends how the algorithms were constructed. I think the best answer to all that, which sometimes ends up being a criticism in some quarters, is that a lot of this is ultimately central banks, plural, interventions to the extent the trillions of dollars have been injected into the economies of the world. And the other part is investors don't want basically a zero return on their fixed income.
Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst, Bankrate.com. Great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
My great pleasure, Steve. My wife will be in the marathon there this weekend.
Oh, great.
You're on.
I will do that. Great to talk to you and good luck to her.